With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello again, everybody, and great to be with you again for another Motorsport Magazine podcast. And today is one for all you bikers. Well, all you racers, really. But we're on two wheels today because we have with us Jeremy McWilliams. He's come all the way from Belfast to be with us today. Well done, Jeremy. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Fantastic. In this podcast today, it's slightly different because we'll be talking to Jeremy. And we've also got lots of nice questions from you, our listeners. But we'll also be getting into our Motorsport Magazine Hall of Fame, won't we, Damien?
Yes, so we've had Formula One, we've had sports cars, and now we're looking at the motorcycle world. So today we're going to ask Jeremy, and we've got Matt Oxley with us as well, who's our motorcycle correspondent, to talk about the great heroes of motorcycle racing and who should go on the shortlist of 12 who you can then vote for to go into the Hall of Fame next year.
Okay. Jeremy McWilliams is a pretty obvious choice, I should think, wouldn't you? Anyway, okay, yeah, we have Matt Oxley, Damien Smith, Simon Aaron, and of course, next to me here, Jeremy. Can I start with something I read about you last night, which is that until Scott Redding came along, you were the only man to get a pole or a win in a MotoGP championship race for a whole decade, is that right?
I think it even seemed like longer than that, to be honest. Yeah, it went on forever and ever. It was always this this kind of thing in the background that somebody had to pick it up from way back in the Barry Sheen days, really. And I was lucky, you know. I wasn't obviously the greatest Grand Prix racer from our shores anyway. I don't believe, but lucky enough to pick up a win in Assen in 2001. A couple of pole positions and a couple of, you know, decent races and podiums, you know, before and afterwards. But I suppose that, you know, that win was just, it was kind of always there for the taking, and I'd never been in the position, or you know, it just hadn't really worked out for me. So it kind of played into my hands because the weather wasn't perfect at Assen, and we made the correct tire choice. And at the time, I remember having a real argument with Dieter Stappert, my team boss, you know, who he wanted me to go with we were on the front row, and he wanted me to go with the same tires as everybody else. Everybody was using wets, and I decided to use intermediates. So, you know, that was kind of half the reason, you know, that we got there. But there was times before that where I'd finished second in Germany in 1998 with Valentino and Caparossi just in behind me, and I think Harada won that race. So there were, I believe, other better races, but of course, you know, a win's a win.
God, wouldn't it be wonderful to say, and Valentino Rossi behind me. Fantastic. Wow, that's worth dining out on. By the way, I should tell you, everybody, that we're in the Chelsea Ram, which is our local pub for Motorsport Magazine. The reason we're here is quite complicated. It's all to do with Jeremy's travelling arrangements. But anyway, we are also moving offices. This coming weekend, we're moving up to Finchley in North London. So we thought it was only right that we should have one last session in the Chelsea Ram. So that's just to explain the surroundings. You rode for Yamaha, you rode for Aprilia, Team KR, you rode for Ilmor. I mean, it's a fantastic career. Do you look back on it and with real pride and pleasure, or do you sometimes think, oh, if only I'd done this, that, or the other?
I think Matt will back me up on this one, but we've always kind of been on the, you know, absolutely no regrets, but never really got to the front of the pecking order for factory machinery. And I suppose, you know, that's part to do with, you know, having a passport from, you know, Northern Ireland. It's it's probably more difficult to get a ride when you're from either UK, you know, Northern Ireland, Ireland, than it would be obviously if you were Spanish or Italian or French even. But no, I mean, I think the rides that I did get, you know, right from even the QB 250 Honda, even before I got factory support from Aprilia, you know, I couldn't have really had any better at the time. You know, even though it wasn't full factory, it was as close to factory as we could get at the time. And we, you know, we were, I think, doing, you know, better than most on a bike that was only a little bit below par. It wasn't too far away from the factory bike. So I look back on those days as, you know, probably the best days of my GP career, even though, you know, later on we went to Aprilia with the factory 500, you know, twin cylinder 500, difficult years, and then Kenny Roberts three cylinder, which again, you know, slightly the underdog, it was much more fun to kind of be biting away at the heels of the factory riders on you know, subpar machinery.
Yeah, I think Jeremy spent most of your career, well, the one thing about Jeremy is his career hasn't finished yet. He's still racing. Age 51, are you now?
Yeah, for my sins, yeah.
And he was kind of always the underdog. He never really had quite the best machinery, but he mentioned the QUB years when he was riding, that's Queen's University Belfast, and remind me of the it was Robert Fleck, but who was the guy before Robert Fleck?
Professor Blair.
Yeah, Professor Gordon Blair, who was a real two-stroke genius. So they were doing an awful lot of two-stroke development at Queen's University Belfast. So I kind of always thought that was a really cool team with a university sponsoring a race team.
Absolutely.
And they were very clever people doing some great things. And it was just lovely to see that a tight little team really giving the factory teams a real hard time.
You've just brought Jeremy in from Heathrow Airport in the back of your Triumph Tiger, haven't you? He looked a bit shaky when he got here, I got to say.
Well, we were in a hurry. We were a bit late.
He's still shaking.
I don't think I really saw. I didn't think. I mean, I'm much worse than that on my own. So, I felt him sort of. You know, when you're going too fast on a bike with a pillion, when you get the sort of the squeeze, when you go for a gap, you feel them trying to make the bike narrower by squeezing their knees in. But we got here in one piece. So, he's refused my offer of a lift onward to Euston. He's
going in the car. I'm used to having my knees out and elbows out, and actually I've never had them so close into my body as I did today. But yeah, if that's something to be experienced. If you might have some tickets in the post, but it got the heart rate up there. Yeah.
Actually, talking about elbows, Jeremy, MotoGP racing or Grand Prix bike racing anyway has changed quite a lot in recent years, hasn't it, in terms of how far you can get that bike over. I mean, do you look at it now and like I do? Well, not like I do, but I just can't believe these angles.
I think obviously the, you know, tire development has come on such a way, you know, and even in 10 years, you know, never mind over 20 years, or, you know, from the Sheen days, tire development, when they were just starting to scrape their knee, you know, back in Kenny Roberts, I think, was one of the first, right to what, you know, Marquez is doing now, which is virtually, you know, shoulder on the tarmac, or, you know, Scott Redding doing the same. Obviously, that's to do with you know, Bridgestone's incredible development of the MotoGP tire. And we were lucky at the beginning when, with Team Roberts, we were actually the first team to use a Bridgestone. So I kind of saw how that was progressing at a very, very, an incredibly fast pace, you know, whereby you'd go to one racetrack and really not have a, you know, have a problem with the tire. You'd have the engineers there, they'd be taking notes, and within 2 weeks they'd come back with a tire that worked on that surface. So very, very clever company, and obviously as time's gone on, they've put that to good practice. You know, the Bridgestone tire at the moment is better than anything's ever been, you know, certainly at MotoGP level, as are the Dunlops in Moto2. But I don't think anybody would believe that they would have been getting the kind of angles that they're getting right now, and you know, sometimes to the detriment, because, you know, it kind of makes it nearly more dangerous in some cases, because there is no limit any longer. It's very, very difficult to find that limit. And even at, you know, warm-up, heat-up times are actually much more critical now than they maybe would have been with tires that don't sort of offer this kind of traction.
It makes for fantastic television, though, Matt, doesn't it? I mean, it's a really great TV sport, and it's, the thing is, it's always exciting. You know, there's always some amazing battle, isn't there?
Yeah, I think now MotoGP is in a really good place. When we had the 800s a few years ago, which were very different motorcycles, a sort of small, much less torque, and there was only one way you could ride them, and everybody got a bit. We had some two or three years of really quite horrible processional racing, but once they've gone back to the thousands, and Bridgestone have kind of made their tires a bit more friendly, so you just get a much bigger mix of people that can ride these things to the limit. And yeah, at the moment it is just astonishing. And also Marquez turning up, you know, he gave everybody a real kind of kick up the ass, and for whatever reason he's not doing it this year. I think he's just not quite getting on with the bike the way he used to. But yeah, him and Rossi, sort of the resurgence of Rossi is obviously just, you know, you couldn't make it up. And then you've got Lorenzo, who, you know, seemed to be finished once Marquez came in, and has now come back. So, it's just astonishingly good at the moment. Every race, you're on the, you are sort of on the edge of your seat, you know.
You are.
I recently watched the Hitting the Apex documentary, which is fantastic. Really enjoyed it, about, you know, the last sort of 15 odd years or so of racing. Do you think this is the best era that we've seen? I mean, it's been such a great era for.
It's a good question. You know, I think that's typical of every generation. Every generation believed that they had the best years of GPs. You know, you go back and listen to anybody that watched or knew Mike Hillwood. You know, that was their. You know, he was in their eyes Mike the Bike, the greatest racer of all time. You know, our era at the moment, my era at the moment, you know, was coming from the Wayne Rooney years into, you know, through Swans, McDoon, right the way through, you know, some amazing riders through my career that I got and raced with, you know, DeGiro Cato, and then Valentino Rossi. And that, I think, is the generation right now have probably got what we believe is the best. But, you know, you speak to that older generation, you know, that they still believe that Mike was or Ralph Brands before that.
Yeah, I think I would say now is the best racing we've had since the era. Jeremy was lucky enough to be, well, when you were first in 500 Grand Prix with Doohan, Schwantz, Lawson, Gardner. That was a very, very, very special era for all kinds of reasons. And I think we're pretty much there now. You know, we've got three, four guys who are battling all the time. And you know, people say these bikes they're easy to ride compared to the 500s. Well, they might be easy to ride, but no bike or car is easy to drive to the limit. They all take a different skill or a different way of riding to take them to the limit. So it doesn't matter what you're on, it's still difficult to take it to the limit. The 500s were less forgiving, but you know, these things can be pretty scary as well. I mean, they're doing 225 miles an hour down the straight at Mugello, you know, cranked over through that kink that didn't even used to be a corner with one wheel in the air. Mm. And then, well, which is where Marquez crashed last year, you know, at 209 miles an hour. I mean, just, you know, I mean, it's scary stuff, which I think it should be. You know, that's why I like it, because it's, you know, it's on the edge of your, you know, you're on the edge of your seat.
When I started my career, you know, from the early days with the 500 Yamaha, it was a privateer Yamaha, but everybody believed that was the most difficult bike to ride back then. I don't believe it was, looking at today's machinery. Certainly it would bite you back. You know, they had a really bad habit of seizing, you know, in the most inopportune time on the circuit, or a gearbox locking up solid, or flicking you over the handlebars, just because it had such a small power band. But I think today's bikes have got to be more difficult to ride than those 500s were.
Who were the riders that inspired the young Jeremy McWilliams?
Way back, you know, we watched the Pro-Am 350 of it, which I think you probably raced in. You got to be old enough to race in that, weren't you?
Yeah, I think I did.
Certainly wasn't Matt that inspired me, but other riders in that generation might have, you know, the Neil McKenzie's and Chambers from memory.
Yeah, Steve Chambers, Neil McKenzie, Kenny Irons, Rob McElnay, all that kind of late, mid-late 80s surge of British talent, which was actually I think we're now back to where we were for the first time since then. We've got a good group of, you know, Jeremy, when he was doing Grand Prix, as far as Brits getting near the front, was pretty much on his own, I think, weren't you? There wasn't really anybody else British around.
There's quite a few at the time. And when I started, there was Sean Emmett and John Reynolds came from British Championship into Grand Prix. So we were kind of the three at the time. Neil McKenzie was still the daddy. You know, he was the one to beat, and it took us a while to get up to the Needles level. And then I remember, you know, beating him then the year after, you know, about 94, 95. And I think that's around about the time when Needle's career, you know, I think he came back to British Championship then, but his GP career kind of, what, you know, basically fizzled out at that time. And so there was really, it was whoever could stick at it the longest, and that's really what happened. It was who could stick it, who could stay there and get another contract year on year was really how we, kind of how we progressed. And it was much easier to walk away from it than it was to keep at it. You know, I pretty nearly walked away from it after 1 year through injuries, you know, picking up really serious injuries and, you know, knocking myself out and, you know, cracking vertebrae and doing all kinds of damage, and to a point, you know, where I had to go and get little operations in my hand to enable it, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome and all kinds of just little minor injuries that kind of maybe just, you know, think at the end of the year, should I be doing this or not? And I carried on. Thankfully, I did, you know, and then it got better, you know. But Grand Prix is such a difficult championship to step into. You know, you see it now. You see riders that are at the top of the level anywhere else in the world. They step into Grand Prix, whether it's anywhere, Moto 3, Moto 2, or Moto GP, and really struggle for, you know, like as Scott has, you know, for a number of years until he's just starting to work his way up to a point where he's competitive.
It's good, though, because it shouldn't be easy, should it? You know, I mean, we're not talking about cars today, but some people say Formula One today is too easy, otherwise these young kids wouldn't be as quick as they are. It should be. I mean, the top should be the absolute top, and it should be a real challenge, shouldn't it?
It is. It you know, it certainly is. It's more, as you say, you know, with Formula One, you know, we still don't really rate Formula One as highly as we rate MotoGP. You know, I'm sitting amongst car people here, and I know it's you okay, probably don't agree with that, but you know, we still believe that, you know, MotoGP is the pinnacle of any motorsport. You know, and I think anybody that watches it as closely as we do, and as Matt was saying, the spectacle that it is today,
fantastic.
You know, you can't not really agree with that.
Okay, let's take some questions from our motorsport magazine readers. Mike Dolan wants to know, Jeremy, if Dorna was to reduce or even take away all the traction control, all the electronic trickery, do you think the same guys would still be at the front?
Yeah, truthfully, yes, I would, because, you know, the factories kind of the factories that want to have the best riders still pay for the best riders, and you know, the best riders will always rise to the top. I think if you took all of that away, though, it would kind of be quite a it would be certainly much more dangerous to be trying to use 250 horsepower with absolutely no electronic aids whatsoever. So that might not be the best idea, but say you reduce the horsepower to a given 200 or whatever and took everything away, then I still believe that you know, the top four or five would still be in the same positions. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Chris Hall wants to know, given that live television is unlikely due to the dangers, what can be done to secure the future of real road racing in Ireland and those other countries where it's still...
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's a really good question, isn't it? That's that's one that everybody will have a different opinion about. And I truly believe that since I've tasted real road racing, because I didn't really do it until I stopped racing Grand Prix. Yeah. And that's kind of what Matt was talking about, where I haven't really retired. I kind of dip in to one or two races a year, one being the Northwest 200, one the Armagh road races, which are, you know, pure road racing. And I think there are... certainly races or events like the TT and the Northwest 200 and the Ulster Grand Prix and the Macau Grand Prix, you know, particular road races that'll never, I don't think will ever cease, where the more the smaller ones are struggling more to keep up, you know, financially, getting the coverage like the Armagh road races do, that, you know, they now get coverage, although it's not live television, it's highlights, you know, broadcast within a week's time of it. But I suppose whilst there's always the hardened road race fanatic, which there are many of in Ireland and Northern Ireland and the Alaman TT, and that, you know, once that, whilst that support's there, those races will always continue. Yeah. And I still think they're absolutely great spectacles to watch a Northwest 200, you know, to watch Hutchie coming back this year, the TT, and having an incredible year after, you know, such a bad patch has been as exciting to watch as maybe MotoGP.
How do you compare, you know, spending most of your career on short circuits, and now you're doing road circuits? How do you compare? Is it more fun? Is it more scary? Is it, you know, what's the difference between racing around a short circuit?
Well, you probably know, because you've done the TT, which is something I've never done. I don't believe I could have learnt the TT in the time that I've been given. You know, it would have taken me probably 2 to 3 years to kind of learn where I was going, and I didn't have that time to put into it. Whereas with the Northwest 200, when you go up and have a look at it, you can tell quite quickly that there's not an awful lot of learning in it. So the approach is quite different. You know, you have to ride with a little bit in reserve. Obviously, you can't just attack it like you would with a circuit. It'd be stupid to try and think that, you know, you can ride it like a short circuit. Even though the riders today, you know, and everybody will know who I'm talking about, you know, the Michael Dunlops, and who look like they absolutely attack it like a short circuit, I still think that every rider keeps that little bit in reserve, you know.
And if you remade the Northwest 200 as a short circuit and stuck it somewhere in a big field, you know, people would go around it faster, wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
You know, if there was nothing to hit.
Yeah.
But do you enjoy sort of racing through sort of villages at 170 miles an hour? Is it kind of quite... I always used to just really enjoy doing silly stuff like that.
Isn't that just like coming from Heathrow with you? It's not the same thing.
Joey,
Matt could take you around the TT course. You're on the back. He could show you around.
You could teach me. Although I think it's past me now. I've definitely got out of my system. I don't want to do it. But yeah. Joey Dunlop used to say, you know, it's just a blur of grey and green, and you try to keep it on the grey part. But that's really what you're doing when it's the build up during the week of the Northwest 200. You know, thankfully, the organisation of the race is really top quality, so you've got time to build into it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're kind of thrown in at the deep end and you have to learn somewhere really quickly, that's when mistakes are made. And you know, you've got 2 days of practice, so you don't really have to go, you know, balls out in the first couple of days. You just get yourself there. And really, I don't really get going until kind of the first race, to be honest.
Yeah. And if you went to the TT, you're a big name. There would be kind of horrible pressure on you to perform, wouldn't there? And you just don't want to go there
I don't think I would be competitive, so there's no point. I'm certainly not going to pretend that I would go there and be quick. I know I wouldn't be, so I'll just basically, you know, I'll give it a miss and do the other things that I'm enjoying doing. You know, we got an invitation to go to Australia in January. I raced the Phillip Island International Classic. I did Indianapolis, the support races over the last 3 years with Harley Davidson, the Northwest 200, the Armoy. Kind of just enough to keep me, you know, just happy enough, you know, just out of, you know.
You're doing a lot of the weird stuff, aren't you? Classic racing, Harley Davidson racing, street racing, just kind of really, I guess it's all different, isn't it? And it's a different, probably a little bit less pressure than what you know, when you were doing it fully professionally and you're enjoying yourself.
I think you think it is until you turn up, and when you turn up, the pressure gets to you, and then you look around at the opposition. The opposition have been racing this championship for the whole year, and you've got to dip in and actually, you know, be competitive, you know, as I did with the Harley Davidson thing. I got as much pleasure out of winning that, you know, as I did winning a Northwest 200 this year with, you know, Ryan Farquhar, my teammate, winning one, and then I won the next one. So I think you... through your career or at end of career, when different things come along, you certainly get as much joy out of riding a bike competitively, wherever it might be.
And do you find that now in your early 50s, the competitive juices are still exactly the same as they were 30 years ago?
I think it's even more fun because everybody knows I'm 50, you know, and they don't expect me to be fast. so that's got another little edge to it, you know, and it's great, you know, being competitive to ride against riders that are in their early 20s still. But as I said earlier, you know, I'm picking and choosing the ones that I know I can do that at, and I'm not trying to dip into championships that I know I'll never be competitive at again. So it's a different
Jeremy
level.
Still does a lot of work for KTM, works on their development team, so he's developing road bikes for them, and you know, so he's still fully locked into to riding all the time. He's done some film work, haven't you? You know, so you've just, along, you just yeah. kind of gone some for weird, hire, really.
It's great the way your career just kinds of, you know, changes direction every other day. You know, you go somewhere else and things have turned up that I would never have dreamed about. But yeah, I'm not really sure what's going to come along, but it's been a lot of fun. Still staying within the industry, and you know what it's like. You know, once you've spent so long doing this, there's not really much else for us out there. You know, you've made your bed and you kind of got to lie in it. So you know, don't fall out with people. Keep those doors open. You know, work with companies and teams and personnel that you've worked with before, and you know, don't burn any bridges. And that's kind of been what my philosophy's been all the way through my career. Try to keep those things open, and it's worked out really well. You know, if you remember, I nearly rode for KTM in about 2005, and for one thing or another, it didn't work out, and Shaky Byrne got the ride, and I walked away from it. But it came back, and now KTM asked me back afterwards, and I've been doing quite a lot of development work, as Matt says, on the road bike stuff, some race stuff, some things that we're talking about for next year. I know one of the questions was, you know, Pike's Peak and what have you. There's talk about that as well, so maybe there's things in the pipeline that are really interesting.
Well, actually, we have a question from somebody called McNewbie. He says, are you serious about running Pike's Peak?
Again, that's a really good question, because, you know, you have to ask yourself, is it worth that risk? You have to weigh up what...
It's a big drop.
It is a big drop, yeah. And when you look at it, you know, you watch the onboard footage, it's bloody frightening. Yeah, it really is. And it's, you know, you kind of think, should I give that a go? And I probably will. I want to go and have a good recce at it and have a look and see. And then have a, you know, try to work out how long to learn that. It's a bit like the TT, isn't it? Yeah. You know, only you've maybe...
How long's the road?
It's about... It's quite a
There's
distance.
There's a lot of corners.
I worked it out in corners. I think it was something like, was it 230 corners or something?
Wow. So that's, yeah. So I like the way you say it's bloody frightening. Yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah. Well, it's really go and have a look. I think a lot of tracks that I look at, I kind of weigh them up in how many blind corners there are. If there's an awful lot of blind stuff, then it's very difficult. And if you can kind of find the apex, then you know, then it should be doable. But we haven't decided on it yet. It is in the pipeline to have a look at.
Well, that's the thing with the TT, that it is nearly pretty much every corner is blind, and right. Generally the apex is, you can't see the apex, you know, and the temptation is always to dive in early, isn't it? Because you think, oh, I want to get into this corner, and that's, you know, if you go in trouble, early, you're going to come out really wide. And
absolutely.
A lot of the TT corners are so fast, you're doing 130, 140 miles an hour, that if you want to change line coming out,
it's no chance.
Ain't going to happen. So, yeah, that's the big thing about the TT is learning all those apexes that you can't see.
Frankly, I'd rather walk to Euston Station this afternoon than go on the back of your Triumph Tiger. No offence, Matt.
I thought I was very sensible and very old, but maybe I'm not.
Jeremy, you mentioned filming work just now, and I've got to ask you about Scarlett Johansson. I think we're all a bit envious of you working with Scarlett Johansson in a film called Under the Skin.
Under the Skin,
what kind of film was it, Jeremy?
It was a bit different, I think we could say. It's a bit arty. Got mixed reviews. Guardian gave it 5 stars. You know, I wouldn't have given it that many, but then again, you know, I suppose I kind of watch different stuff, and it was one of those kind of things that a door opened. You know, I got a phone call and they asked me could I come along and ride in a movie. They wanted a bad guy in it, and I kind of thought, you know, somebody was pulling my leg, and then it transpired that, you know, when I spoke to the producer, that it was what it was. And getting to work with Scarlett and ride through the highlands of Scotland in the dead of winter was something else. It was something quite different, but and I did enjoy. I really enjoyed getting into the character, I suppose, you know, into the scene. That's as much fun as jumping into a race, because, you know, you've got to pull it off. You can't really make any mistakes. You've got a certain time to do it, and so you could kind of relate it to a little bit to how you prepare for a, you know, for a one-off fast lap or something, you know, and that's, it was certainly one of those things. You know, I never thought I would have had the chance to work with Scarlett Johansson or even work with anybody in the movie, to be perfectly honest. But it came along and I took it up and really enjoyed doing it. Yeah.
Okay, everybody. Well, you missed. If you want to see the film, it's called Under the Skin. And it stars Jeremy McWilliams and Scarlett Johansson. How about that? And I think you were saying it might be on Channel 4 soon.
Well, I think it was Channel 4 supported, and I believe it was either on last Thursday or this Thursday. It's on. It's okay. They are now airing it on. It was in the movies, and now it's hit the TV. So
okay, we've got to ask both of you, Matt Oxley and Jeremy. At least I particularly want to ask you about Valentino Rossi this year. I mean, you've raced against Rossi, for heaven's sake. I mean, this guy, it really is. It's a piece of history, right, Matt? I mean, it's in every single way, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's completely, well, as far as I'm aware, it's completely unique to be at the top of any sport for 20 years. Is remarkable to be as on the top of something like motorcycle racing, which is, you know, let's face it, it is reasonably dangerous, and you know, even if you get out of it all right, generally, well, ask Jeremy, you know, you get injured a lot, and eventually you get fed up with being injured, and you give up, but Rossi just keeps on going, and even, you know, do you think what happened to him, especially in 2011, 2012, two horrible years with Ducati, crashed, you know, 3-4 times as much as he did normally, kept getting battered about, and then was involved in that horrible crash with Simoncelli, yeah. You know, his best mate, he was involved in the crash. You know, I mean, it's just, yeah, I cannot work out in my own head how he manages to do that in his own head. And yeah, it's just fantastic. I mean, somebody was saying maybe Steve Redgrave was at the top of his sport for 20 years. I'm not sure, you know, the rower. But kind of rowing is a little bit different from motorbike racing. I'm not in any way denigrating what
he achieved. Sure.
But you know, it's just astonishing and just wonderful to see.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah.
As a top rider yourself, what is it about the guy that makes him just that? What is it he's got?
Well, he's certainly something very, very special, and really, you know, MotoGP is kind of revolving around the Rossi era, still is. There are other great riders, but not great characters, and I think, you know, that's what typifies Valentino. He's determined. Obviously, he's really determined, and what I really love about him is that it's nothing to do with the money any longer, because he's got more than he'll ever need, but the fact that he kind of wants to race for position, even though he kind of should be thinking about points, like in the last race where he fought, you know, with Pedrosa, and really wanted those 5 points more than anybody else. But, you know, he wasn't prepared just to sit back and give Pedrosa the second position. He wanted it so badly from him. So I think that kind of typifies what the man is. He loves you know, just being in front of anybody else. He wants to win. He wants to win world championships at a ripe old age of 36 or 37, whatever he is now. And I think that's why we all love him, because he's just not kind of fading away, where we all expect riders of that age to slowly fall down the order and, you know, basically, you know, melt away. But he just keeps at it, and he's given 100%, you know, regardless whether he's going to crash out or whatever. I think that's why we love watching MotoGP at the minute.
And the lovely, at Aragon, you know, when he got beaten by Danny, you know, those points that he lost there could prove crucial to the outcome of the World Championship. And yet, in the press conference, in the press conference afterwards, he was completely relaxed and happy. You know, a lot of riders would come in there thunder-faced, thinking, I've lost those points, I'm so angry. But he just seems to be one step ahead of it all the time and just enjoying it for what it is. And I think he's just particularly enjoying being in the battle for the World Championship. Obviously, he wants to win it. Even if he loses it, he'll just shrug his shoulders and go, well, you know, I tried, but I gave it, and I had a lot of fun doing it. And there's very few riders that can, I think, get that much enjoyment out of it, you know, whether they're winning or slight just getting beaten, you know, like he did on Sunday. But and I think that is one of the things. He just loves it, you know. And
it's the elation of winning, you know. That's really what it's about. There's nothing comes close, you know. There isn't anything else that gives you that feeling.
Doing it better than everybody else. Yeah.
There isn't anything. Yeah.
Sure. Okay, Damien, let's get on to the Hall of Fame, because although we're mainly a car racing magazine, we also obviously include motorcycling, and it would be ridiculous not to. Agostini is already in our Hall of Fame.
Yes, well, there's three bikers so far in the Hall of Fame. So Surtees, who obviously straddles both worlds, Agostini and John McGuinness. So that gives you a flavour of what we're about. So it's obviously the big names, but in McGuinness's case, someone who didn't achieve anything in Grand Prix racing, but it's for his TT record and for what he brings to the sport as a character, which I think is part of the Hall of Fame as well. It's about what you bring to the sport and the personality you are and how the fans react to you. So it's these kind of guys that we're talking about. I mean, I've got a short list of people that I would put forward for the bike list. Simon has. I'm sure Matt's got lots of ideas.
Shall we go around the table with the short?
Yeah. I mean, Rossi for me is an obvious one to top the list as someone who's got to go on this list because he's still current, which is something we try to actually shy away from for the Hall of Fame. But how can you not include Rossi? And as you say, Matt, to have such a long career, it's something incredible.
Yeah, he's completely unique. There is no one like him. I mean, unique is an overused and poorly used word often, but he is unique. And I mean, I would add Hailwood to that. I would add Rainey. I would add Doohan. I would add who else?
Kevin Schwantz.
They're all on my list.
Yeah, Schwantz maybe. You know, it's really Schwantz would be well up there. You know, once you get past Rossi and Hailwood, who I would say were the only two who are just absolutely, you cannot argue. After that, you get
would
into
you agree
a.
With that,
yeah, I would agree with you. You know, certainly, we never saw the best of Wayne Rainey. You know, he was unbelievable at the time and a big influence in my early GP career. You know, it was my favourite rider at the time. I suppose I can still call him my favourite rider. But then the Doohan years were, you know, so he was dominating. A bit like Valentino is dominating right now, so I mean, Doohan would have to fall into that category. I suppose, you know, other riders. I had John Surtees. I didn't realise that he was in the Hall of Fame already. You know, just because he's the only person that's obviously done it in two and four wheel. Other riders that influenced me, or I watched way back in the day. You know, like the Tom Herons, winning, you know, world championships on 250 and 350 at the time. But
would you put Barry Sheen in there?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, yeah. Of course, Barry would have to rank right up there. Of course, he would. Yeah, and but I suppose, you know, because of Kenny, and I worked for Kenny, I rode for Kenny, and I kind of nearly would rate Kenny Roberts above Barry.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's.
In fact, when I said Rossi and Hailwood would be my, you know, top two. And then there's a bit of a drop after that. I think Kenny would come
in there, yeah.
Quite close after that. And then you come into your Raineys and Schwantzes and Doohans and so on
Gardner.
And so forth. Yeah, he'd be up there, but I think he'd be down another step from Rainey and Schwantz and Lawson and people like that. You know,
when you're talking about Hall of Fame, it really has to be somebody who's, you know, very special.
Yeah, you're right.
The Kenny Roberts thing is interesting because he was the first American to come over and do it in Grand Prix racing, and he changed the nature of racing coming from the dirt bike world. So it's the influence that he had on the sport as well, as much as what he achieved,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, until Marquez turned up, he was the guy that came in and just did stuff different from the way everybody else was doing, and everybody else had to kind of catch up and learn from him. And not only that, you know, he won three world championships. His first three world championships straight off the bat, having never even been to Europe before. And the first year, he wasn't even a full factory rider. He had one bike.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the middle of the season where Yamaha were like, oh, we better give you Chicotto's bike to kind of, you know, your Chicotto's spare bike to kind of qualify on at Spa or something. So, I mean, you know, to do that, and he was racing a 250 and a 750 at the same time. So, I mean, you know, when racing was much more chaotic than it is now. Yeah. And then after that, he went on to run his own team, and he won three more world championship with Wayne Rainey and one with Kaczynski. And then he went on and built his own motorbike from the ground up, which
road,
Williams rode and scored the last two-stroke pole position on. So to do that, I mean, no one has ever done that, probably ever will do
it. And the team management distinction, again, is something that Wayne Rainey, of course, subsequently did very successful. One name we haven't come to yet, but I think should definitely be on the list, is Gerry Dunlop.
Absolutely,
again, no Grand Prix success, but I mean, all of those TT wins, I mean, just under cult. I mean, I know he didn't have the outgoing extrovert personality of a Rossi or whatever, but I mean, as a cult hero, I mean
50,000 people turned up at his funeral. I mean, that's all you need to know. And not only that, what he did during the Bosnia War, which was he would go around his hometown area and around Belfast, filling his van full of medicines, clothes, food, whatever, on his own,
and driving,
not telling anybody about this, and then locking it up and driving down to Bosnia, driving through sort of Serbian sort of, you know, roadblocks and stuff to deliver this stuff. I mean, and never did any PR or media or anything about it, on his own, and then drove home again.
And Formula One world champion as well. You know, we typically remember Joey for his TT success, but he was a Formula One world champion as well.
Something you said interested me just now when you said that Kenny Roberts was your favourite rider. Can you explain that a bit? So when you were younger and you were kind of starting into it, did you watch the guy and think, you know, I can see what he does on the bike? And
he was just before my era, but we all knew about him, and it was nearly before it was really accessible, as I remember, you know, to watch it on TV, you know, like. Because back then, I'm going back a few years now, but you know, it was Grandstand, you know, whenever I was a kid. Then when we started to watch, racing proper, you know, Wayne Rainey was the one to me that was at that time, just before I got into racing Grand Prix, because it's 1992, I believe, too. Yeah. You know, were very, very special years on. When you watched, you know, Wayne Rainey on a bike, that was with Team Roberts, and so that it was a kind of perfect package. You know, I think that, you know, if you wanted to be anywhere, that's the team you'd want to be part of. You know, it was very, very special. But you know, Wayne Rainey, I remember a ride at Suzuka. You know, it'll always stick out in my mind where he went backwards and then came back through again and won it.
That's what he after the race. Well, where he said he had an out of body moment, and I think Senna is the only other guy that I've ever heard of talk about that. And he actually said that, you know, he was going around and he was looking at himself and laughing.
And he was sideways.
Yeah, because he could just do things, because he was on Dunlops that year, and he could just do things with the tires, pivot the bike, and did it. And he won the race, having dropped back to like fourth or fifth, and came back and got Doohan and Schwantz and Gardner or Lawson or whoever it was. And in the press conference, he was, you know, wanted to talk about the out-of-body experience, but he didn't dare because he thought, oh God, if I talk about this, these people won't let me back on a motorbike again. So, I think to have an out-of-body experience like that is pretty special. You know, it's kind of really tells you a lot about the weird things that's going on in your brain when you're riding a motorbike or driving a car at the absolute limit, getting into your subconscious and all that kind of stuff. It's fascinating, you know.
So I wanted to ask you, looking back, what was the best hour you ever spent on a motorbike? I mean, what was it, you know, when you really had that feeling?
There's plenty of those, you know, believe it or not, you know, that kind of does happen when everything just flicks, you know, it kind of comes together and it becomes effortless. Doesn't happen very often. But, you know, there are times where you think, I couldn't have raced that race any better. You know, I've probably done as much as I ever could. And you get, you know, maybe one every 5 years, I suppose, or 10 years it could be. But I suppose that, you know, that would hark back for me back to the 98 race, you know, when I was battling on a private 250 and trying to catch what I could see with the three factory Aprilias in front, and caught up behind Valentino and Caparossi, and then had a fuel pipe come off the top of the tank, so the breather pipe, which, do you remember the old one, which used to stick on the top and then go like this around the screen, and down into a catch bottle. Well, that popped off the top and covered me in fuel at Sachsenring. But Sachsenring at the time was a shorter circuit than it is today. So there was no really long straights. So kind of, you know, the Aprilias couldn't really get away. So I managed to, I caught them up and then, of course, got covered in fuel. Managed to, you know, flap about and get it back on again. Of course, they disappeared. I thought that was it all over. And then managed to catch them up again. You know, over the, it's a, you know, 250 race, you know, around Sachsenring was a long affair. You had probably 40, 45 minutes at the time. Caught them back up, got past them one lap after another, finished second, had a huge moment, lost the front end, which I don't even remember anything about until Valentino reminded me on the podium and he said, "Oh, you nearly crashed." I was like, what are you talking about? He says, the black line that came off your front tire on the last lap, he said, went on for, you know, 50 meters, and I was so elated of, you know, what I just achieved, I completely forgot about it. So it's one of those races where, you know, I probably should have crashed, but I made it, finished second, and Valentino was there.
What about Donington 2000 when you were battling for the lead on a damp track on the Aprilia Twin with Valentino Rossi, who hadn't at that point won a 500 race? You spent the whole race battling back and forth on a drying line, I think, with Valentino, also Kenny Roberts Jr. On the Suzuki, and you were ahead. You got ahead. You were kind of pulling away, and then did you have the wrong time? I mean, that must have been amazing, battling back and forth with Rossi.
I came up through from nowhere, Matt. I was, you know, way back on the fourth row or something, and came through, damn track. We'd obviously made our tire choice. Everybody was on wets, but there were different compounds of wet. I was on a twin cylinder Aprilia, so it was a lighter bike, much more like a 250. They were on four cylinder. Valentino was on a V4 Honda, and Kenny was on a Suzuki. But you know, you make a choice, and you think, you know, you go with it. And I just took a slightly softer tire, you know, than I could have taken. But then again, had I taken the harder tire, you know, would I have caught them? And I led the race for about 13 or 14 laps, and it was one of those things that just came really easily. And then when I got to the front, I thought, okay, let's make a break. You know, rather than, had I kind of, you know, bided my time, I probably would have had something left at the end. I had no tire left at the very end of the race, and unfortunately went, you know, moved back from first into third, but still one of the, you know, the best, you know, most fun I've had on a bike, and great for the British crowd, because we got a track invasion. I could hardly get back again, you know, and I'd only finished third, so imagine what would have happened had I won it. But yeah, it was no regrets, really enjoyed it.
They'll want you in the Hall of Fame, that lot will, because they'll be listening to this. Anyway, Damien, we must get back, because we must sort of come to a decision about...
Yeah, well, so far we've got seven or eight names on the list. So we've got Rossi, Hailwood, someone we've mentioned as an obvious person. Can we just sort of talk about why Hailwood's so special? What is it about him?
I only ever saw him race once or twice when he came back on the Ducati in 78. So I can only comment from having spoken to riders who rode against him, people like Ralph Bryans, who was a Fatchy Honda rider when he was, and so on, who was out on the track with him. And he was talking to me about a track they raced at in Finland, Tampere, I think, which is very, very dangerous, tree-lined everywhere, and bumpy, and sort of gravel on the track here and there. And they went out, and Tailwood came round him in practice, and just the whole bike sort of grinding on the floor, stepping out sideways, and on the verge of crashing. And Bryans was like, holy moly, you know, he's not going to do that again. And he was sort of chasing him, and Hailwood was doing the same thing at the same corner every lap. The things were all ground out, sideways, out of shape, apparently crashing and just carrying on. And when Ralph spoke to him after practice, like, wow, Hailwood was like, oh yeah, whatever. You know, he was just a complete natural. He wasn't very... He was sort of famously technophobic, but he could ride anything. You know, I mean, he won a 125, 250 and a 500 Grand Prix at the same weekend, you know. He could ride two strokes, he could ride four strokes, ride big bikes, he could ride little bikes, he could ride short circuits, he could ride the TT. You know, he came back after 11 or 12 years out of racing and won the TT, you know. So I think a bit like Rossi, he's just up there with the kind of gods, if you like, you know, just...
But he is, you know, one of those riders that in the day when you had to win on both roads and circuits, you know, and he was, you know, multiple world champion and multiple TT winner as well. So he definitely ranks right up there, particularly as Matt said, when he came back 9 years later, after he, you know, he quit and came back and then won on a Ducati. Never ridden a Ducati, you know, never raced a Ducati, and he won the TT. He won a senior, actually.
Yeah, and a hell of a nice guy as well, you know, and obviously very pretty good at car racing, and
he
won the George Cross, the highest civilian medal in this country for getting, who was it, out
Clay,
of the car at the
Clay,
right, okay, so, you know, there's somebody who owes his life to Mike Hailwood. I mean, you can't get any better than that, really, can you? So
no.
And yes, we've got Rossi and Hailwood obviously on the list, and we talk about eras, and it's almost like there was a Rainey era, followed by a Doohan era. What was it about those two guys that that meant that they stood out above the crowd?
Yeah, I raced against both. Unfortunately, Wayne had his accident in '93 when I started, so I didn't get to race with him after that. Whereas with Doohan, Doohan really etched himself on and anybody that raced against him, because he was quite a really, really hard character. Really not a particularly nice person to get on with on the track. Lovely off, but on the track, you know, he owned the track. Kind of a little bit, you know, like they are now with Marquez, and I suppose, you know, there's that trait in many of those incredible riders. But Doohan had no time for anybody on the track. You know, he believed that was his part of the track, and if you were on it, he was going to run over the top of you. Yeah, which he tried to do quite a bit, you know, with us, particularly privateers. It took a long time to actually get any recognition from the man at all, you know. I had a fair few run-ins with him right the way through my first couple of years, you know, that would take a long time to talk about. But in the end, he got some mutual respect from me from somewhere, somehow. And since then, we got on. Just in our own, you know, never friends, close friends, but on track he was something else. I suppose Doohan had more influence on me because I raced against him much longer, and he was a machine, you know, he was a robot, and I think, you know, that Mick Doohan for me would definitely rank as one of those riders that would need to be certainly considered for the Hall of Fame.
And Rainey, I always just think of as a double act with Schwantz. It was, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that was. You know, that was your sort of archetypal grudge match. You know, they grew up together racing each other in the States, and you know, it wasn't a media hype thing. They truly did hate each other. You know, if they walked into the same restaurant, they would sit at opposite ends of the restaurant. They didn't talk to each
really?
Other.
Wow.
I mean, it was a really, and it was still like that when they got to Grand Prix. You know, Rainey got so obsessed with it sometimes. You know, he was more obsessed about beating Schwantz than winning a race in a funny kind of way, and didn't matter where he was, he just wanted to beat Schwantz.
It's a bit like Valentino and Lorenzo now, isn't it, really?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think with Lorenzo and Valentino, it's all sort of, they've sort of got the sort of dislike for each other kind of fairly under kind of wraps now, haven't they? But without a doubt, it's there, you know. Rainey, Schwantz, Doohan, they all just had that astonishing control of those 500 two-strokes, which were evil things. You know, if you're a very narrow power band, the tyres weren't as good then. It was the era of the high side when, you know, you get on the throttle, the tyre spins out, you shut the throttle, the tyre grips, and you're 10 feet in the air doing 130 miles an hour. They were three guys who could ride those things absolutely to the limit, spinning the tyre out the corner. You know, they knew how to get get it over the top of the torque curve, I think, was what Doohan always used to talk about. You know, if you could
get it revving,
shut the throttle, keep the revs going to get over the top of the torque curve, and then the tyre will keep spinning and it won't
bite
and grip. So, you know, I mean, just amazing skills to ride those things. And you know, they all ended their careers injured in one way or another. Rainey, obviously, very badly. Doohan, pretty badly. And Schwantz also, you know, they all stopped racing when they had more in them, because those things, but even more, at their level, hurt them, you know.
More astonishing, you know, was Doohan's comeback when anybody else would have given up. You know, that would, for me, I'm not sure how many other riders could have gone through that at the time. You know, you saw it. It was
the only guy now is Ian Hutchinson, I mean, Doohan, it came very close to having his leg amputated and had his legs sewn together for 6 weeks, and then came back racing like 2 weeks after they had been taken apart, and missed the world championship by one point from Rainey like that. And now you have Ian Hutchinson, who's come back from a similar, you know, the doctors wanted to amputate his leg, and he's come back, and, you know, he's winning Grand Prix again and TTs again. And I just don't think any of us, well, certainly I can't, just imagine how anybody could do that.
Personally, I think anybody who races a motorcycle should be in the Hall of Fame. Every time I watch it, I can't.
It's really difficult doing this because we're trying to get a dozen names from the history of motorcycle racing.
Casey Stoner, we haven't talked about Casey Stoner.
Yeah, we've got at the moment we've got Rossi, Hailwood, Rainey, Doohan. We talked about King Kenny, Joey Dunlop, Schwantz. Maybe
I think he'd be in the top 12. Yeah.
Okay.
I think
did he lose his appetite a little bit after Wayne Rainey had his accident?
Oh, definitely.
Because the trigger had gone.
It completely destroyed him. Yeah.
Plus, he was carrying injuries, you know, that he didn't deal with very well at that, you know, at that time, and it was easier to walk away from it than to carry on. Yeah. You know, he still got, you know, lasting repercussions from those injuries, obviously, but they were. It's difficult to ride at all when you're carrying those kind of injuries.
And I think he knew that Rainey crashed a lot less than he did, and there was Rainey, poor Wayne, in a wheelchair, and I think he just thought, hang on, you know, the odds are stacking up on me. And I think he won a couple of Grand Prix after that, but the moment he gave up was, I think, at a winter testing crash he had at Phillip Island, and had quite a big crash at high speed and landed, and then, you know, about half a second later, the bike came out of the sky and landed about a foot next to him. You know, and he just was like, right, okay, I'm not going to... That's a sign. I'm going to stop now.
Okay.
And on all so far, we also talk about Sheen. We haven't really talked about him as such. I mean, you know, he won two titles. He was amazingly fast. The thunder was well and truly stolen, though, as soon as King Kenny came along. So what is it about Sheen, though, that stands out, why he should be on this list, do you think?
I mean, you know, huge respect for Barry and so on, but I would put him at... I think I'd probably stick him in the top 12 somewhere, but he would be in the lower reaches of it. I mean, he won two world titles and then kind of had his ass kicked by Kenny for several years, but then did actually come back from that, and until he had that huge crash at Silverstone in 82, he was still competitive. And I think if he hadn't had that, I think that you might have had a kind of second Sheen era, you know, if he'd had the right bites and everything. So, yeah, I think he should be there, definitely.
Rob, you mentioned Stoner. He was on my list as well. What do you think about Casey Stoner?
I mean, it's up to Jeremy and Matt to decide, because I'm not qualified to decide. I just thought Casey, you know, I mean, I watched him a lot. He won a lot of races. He seems to be unpopular for some reason. I don't know. What do we think?
He's just an atypical type of... racer again, that Australian, you know, kind of hardhead, really, and very Doohan-esque about him, and it didn't kind of go out to make friends, and he certainly made no secret of that. You know, he would have he didn't suffer fools lightly, and or other riders.
as you found out with Scarlett Johansson, it's great to have a bad guy, isn't it? Yeah. he was kind of, you know,
kind of need one, don't you? Yeah. But then again, you need a good guy at the same time.
The thing was that he had no interest in being. He was very like Mick. That he had no interest in being famous. He had no interest in being a personality. He had no interest in opening supermarkets or earning money through, you know, doing other things. He just wanted to race motorbikes. And go home.
And he did fish.
It's exactly what he did, you know. There were many things that made Casey special, but the one thing that really killed everybody else when he was around was his ability to go out, lights go out, first corner, he's absolutely right on the limit. Totally, and he'll do that for the first lap, and in the first lap he'll gain 1 or 2 seconds. And very hard to... And that Lorenzo learned that, and Lorenzo spent one winter... several winters ago basically doing that during testing, full tank, straight out the pits, and just go 100%. And that's why he's winning now.
Senna and Hamilton did the same sort of thing.
Yeah, if he wasn't doing that, he wouldn't be fighting for the championship.
Riders learn off each other, you know, they copy each other, and you can see that at the moment, you know, and there's no secret about, you know, Valentino copying Marquez's style, for instance, you know, as did... Jorge, you know, copy what Casey was doing, because Casey could turn up at a track and, you know, wheel the bike out of the garage for the first free practice session and be a second and a half faster than anybody for the first 20 minutes. So he would basically just go out and absolutely push everything to the limit, kind of just to
stamp his
authority on it, and make everybody feel a little bit inadequate, He was very good at that.
I think we've just been speaking about Lorenzo. I think he'd, you know, the... I think he would be in there again in the lower reaches. And also Eddie Lawson, of course, he would definitely be in there. You know, he won four world titles when 500s were pretty...
Another one that springs to mind, you know, would be even Freddie Spencer winning two world championships in the, in 1 year, 250 and 500.
But, and then never winning another Grand Prix.
Yeah, that's strange. Yeah, yeah. That, because, you know, when you win two and you're so dominant over two, which I didn't believe would be possible in 1 year, you know, not to come back, as you say, and not win anything again.
Can I go back a little bit to, even to before Jeremy's time, and throw Jeff Duke into the mix? Because I mean, he won, was it six world championships? And but I think there was also a bit of a rebel about Jeff Duke, wasn't there? Because wouldn't he have won a seventh maybe if he hadn't been suspended for striking and demand for great more pay?
Wasn't demanding more pay for him.
No, that was actually for riders.
He was a factory rider, and. Because some privateers had helped him in some protest to get, I think in Italy or something at some point back then when he was first riding for Gilera, they only paid Italians prize money or start money, and he managed to get the Italians to come on his side and say that he should be paid. So when all the privateers went on strike at Assen in 1955, saying basically we want me, you know, we're not performing circus animals, you know, we need money, and I think they got 20 quid a start or something, that was the offer or something. And Duke went on strike in support of them. You know, he was wealthy, had nothing to go on strike for. But so, again, he had that something beyond him rather than just being a very successful rider. He kind of cared about other riders.
And also, despite racing in the era he did, he lived on into his 90s. So I think on many, many levels, a remarkable bloke.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Then we're running out of time.
We are running out of time because Jeremy's got a car waiting for him. So, we have got a dozen names here. I'll just run through, and you can tell me if you think there's anyone glaring that we've missed off. So we've got Rossi, Hailwood, Rainey, Doohan, Sheen, King Kenny, Joey Dunlop, Schwantz, Stoner, Lorenzo, Spencer, and Duke are our dozen. Actually, there's no Lawson on there.
No, we couldn't.
We've got no sidecar competitors.
Can we have an unlucky 13? Or isn't that allowed?
No, it has to be 12.
No sidecar races. No. Steve Webster must be on the list, surely.
We completely miscounted and ended up with 15, so it won't be the first time. Oh, dear. So, I miscounted, actually.
And any thoughts on sidecars, Matt?
I'm ashamed to say they never floated my boat.
You have no thoughts about them at all?
They don't. You know, I like two wheels.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to make an editor's decision. I'll take Lorenzo out just because he's still got a long way to go. Yeah, I think he's, you know, Rossi he must be surely coming towards the end of his career. Must be in the autumn of his career, at least.
Whereas
Lorenzo, you can see.
I wouldn't jump to any conclusions.
No, that's true. So if we add in Lawson, that makes it up to a dozen. But is there anyone else there that we've missed off?
Well, you know, you're going to get told you've forgotten about such and such and so on.
Yeah, that's
half the fun. Yeah. Getting told off.
So should we leave it at that for?
Yeah, because I think it's an ongoing thing. I mean, the Hall of Fame isn't until the middle of next year.
No, the voting will last now until the spring of next year, before we actually close the polls. And as I say, this is an annual thing, so next year we'll do this again, basically, and come up with another list, similar to this one, I'm sure. But yeah, we can always add other names onto it at that stage.
And they'll be on the website, on the motorsportmagazine.com.
Yeah, so after this podcast, you can go straight to cast your vote online. And as I say, it'll be open for quite some time yet. So
fantastic. Come on, all you bikers, all you motorcycle racers, all you fans. Get voting. And if we've got it wrong, you tell us. And Jeremy Williams, thank you so much.
Thank you for dropping in
between Belfast and Silverstone and a few other places that you're about to go to now. Yeah. Thank you very, very much.
Pretty little logo you got here. It's nice. Yeah.
Shame we're not here.
It's not bad. We're moving office this weekend, so this is a goodbye to Chelsea, actually, for us. So it's nice. The Ram, we've recorded a couple of podcasts here before, and it's our local, so it's a goodbye to the Ram as well.
Goodbye from me, goodbye from all of us, goodbye from the Ram, and we'll see you in our new headquarters next time we're with you. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.